This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York, Queens College.
I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman from UCLA.
Today, teenage suicide. Our guests are Anna Muller from the University of Chicago and Seth Aberton from the University of British Columbia. Our discussion was recorded on Wednesday, March 13th, 2019. Okay, we're here with Seth Aberton of UBC and Anna Muller from the University of Chicago. They're both part of a dynamic duo that's been doing tons of work on suicide. And it's great to have them. You have a publication coming out soon in Society and Mental Health.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
And a book in the works. You want to tell us a little bit about it before we get started?
Sure. So the book is kind of a deeper look into the case of Poplar Grove, which we wrote about in our in a publication we had called Adolescents Under Pressure in 2016 that came out in the American Sociological Review. And it's basically, it takes the case of this community with a really serious and enduring adolescent suicide problem that includes repeating youth suicide clusters that are all centered around this one high school in the community. And we're basically trying to understand like what is happening when a school in a community sort of houses such a substantial youth suicide problem.
It's interesting. And you framed your work, I love the framing, as like a post-Durkheimian view of suicide.
You know, I think that there's two components to the sort of Durkheimian stance. And the first one is the sort of overwhelming amount of research that in sociology, which isn't that much as it is on suicide, kind of takes that sort of structural approach where we study aggregated data like suicide rates and compare, you know, New York to California or, you know, Switzerland to England. And then the sort of second component, and so we're not really interested in that. We're more interested in like why someone would choose to die by suicide or how that when you're exposed to somebody's death affects you, which sort of was outside of Durkheim's wheelhouse. But the other component is Durkheim gives us this typology of suicides. It's based on the idea that there's either too much of like social networks or social ties, too much integration or solidarity, and too little. Mm-hmm. But Durkheim himself sort of rejected the too much side. He kind of wrote it off as being a relic of like the old pre-modern societies. And in, you know, modern, urban, differentiated places, it's all about anomie, and it's all about like the loss of social relationships. Hmm. And that story, that explanatory framework just doesn't make sense in a place like Poplar Grove. Or in fact, it doesn't really make sense in any place where there are suicide clusters like prisons or psychiatric wards or some indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to kind of move past this reliance on, you know, not an antiquated book because it's not antiquated, but it's sort of like a crystallized way of thinking about suicide in sociology.
You know, so it's two things. I think that sociology, frankly, is very obsessed with Durkheim. If you work in the area of suicide, you're going to be required to engage Durkheim. And while I'm one of his number one fans, you know, we have a much broader, you know, theoretical toolkit that we could apply to this. You know, right now it's a really serious social problem. And, you know, really honestly, like we kept trying to bring in other theoretical perspectives, and reviewers kept telling us, but shouldn't you be talking about Durkheim?
Yeah.
Durkheim. And, you know, and so finally we were just like, all right, you know what, if we can't get beyond Durkheim, then we're going to rewrite Durkheim to serve our needs. And so that's why it's called like a new Durkheimian approach to understanding suicide. And yes, as everything that Seth also said is totally true, that, you know, there's broad things that Durkheim sort of neglects or underplays or, you know, sort of poo-poos from the start. And we pick up, you know, so we basically end up building on his foundation. But I think the sort of rhetorical choice of building a new Durkheimian framework was in part because at that particular moment in our career, reviewers wouldn't let us move past Durkheim.
Oh, I'm sure, right? This is such a backward-looking discipline that you got to fit no matter what you're doing, you have to fit in an 100-year-old scholar, even though plenty has happened between then and now. But
although to be fair to Durkheim, he actually is like, we know very little about suicide. And actually one of the enduring insights that we have comes from Durkheim. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting that, you know, at the same time that I want to move past him, like multiple disciplines actually credit him with one of the most profound insights into suicide, which is that social isolation and lacking those sort of socially supportive ties is really really traumatic for our mental health and deeply increases our vulnerability to suicide.
Yeah, it's true. You think of a sad sack, somebody who's sitting alone in isolate, it's not worth going on. But you guys have more of a social contagion type of view is what I gathered from it. Do you want to explain to me how you have come to see suicide, the causes of suicide? Through your work, the social causes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that we're sometimes I give myself a headache when trying to think about these things, but we've ultimately, you know, when we went in and we did this work, originally Seth and I were very interested in processes related to suicide diffusion and how it is that suicide can become like, quote unquote, socially contagious. Mm-hmm. That was really our core motivating question. When we got to Poplar Grove during fieldwork, we quickly realized that, yes, there were processes that were directly related to sort of exposure to suicide and how that then changes how a child imagines suicide and particularly imagines it as applicable to the self. And that's the paper that is actually going to come out in a couple months at Society and Mental Health. Nice. But we also basically found that there was this real serious role of a shared environment that was surrounding these more sort of dyadic diffusion processes. Mm-hmm. And in that way, we were, you know, one of our big goals is to begin to build a more comprehensive model of social vulnerability to suicide that includes both the more Durkheimian shared environment, social contextual factors, and a consideration for what happens when we are exposed to something that changes our ability to imagine it as an option for the self.
Right. And you know, the big counterintuitive thing that we found, and almost right off the bat, I think it was the first day of we were doing focus groups and we were again debriefing on them, was, you know, in sociology, it's kind of taken for granted this idea that lots of social support is good, you know, that it's rooted almost in the very classical training that we get in Zimmel and Weber and Durkheim and Marx. They're all like lamenting these modern urban societies and like the disintegration of our social ties. And here we are in this community that has, you know, it's mechanical solidarity. It's strong social integration. We have people telling us that they love this community because their kids are being looked after by all their neighbors when they're not home, that everybody goes to the community pool, that everybody like knows each other really well. And so on the one hand, you know, this is counterintuitive. It's against everything that sociologists talk about, and especially sociologists that study suicide, we're always looking at, oh, there was an economic recession. How did this like lead to more suicides? Or, oh, divorce and its relationship to suicide. Here we have the opposite, right? And then on top of this, we have a very affluent community where you would think that they have the resources to, you know, combat this, or at least be attempting to combat this by just throwing money at it, you know, hiring counselors and school counselors and, you know, bringing in experts in the field to implement programs and whatnot. And they were struggling, you know, quite frankly, struggling with dealing with the problem.
I have a question about that, actually. How much of that is like too much integration, and how much of it is, you know, that reminds me of, you know, of Coleman, you know, when Coleman would write about functional communities, mm-hmm. right? And he'd say that, like, you know, intergenerational social closure is great, right? But, you know, when this occurs in a totally functional community, the danger of that is, you know, since everybody knows everybody else's business, mm-hmm. since, you know, everybody's reputation is caught up in the reputation of everyone else's, then, you know, if your son, for example, does something wrong, then, you know, the entire community will look at your whole family and you will feel shame, right? And
that is exactly what we found. You know, I think another really key element to why this really intense level of social connectedness became harmful was because it was paired with really narrow cultural beliefs about what a good kid was or what an ideal family looked like. And so absolutely, you know, and along with that, also having a mental illness or even being seen to struggle under the intense sort of academic and athletic expectations that were really important to the community, having that stress or strain was very much seen as contrary to these ideals. And so that sets up a situation where even where failure becomes incredibly painful and terrifying, and or even just like the prospect of possibly failing, you know. So it was a pretty intense place for these kids, and they often didn't really see that they had any other way out. And then on top of that, they often were very proud of their community. And so it was like this was like a place where they wanted to belong. And when they struggled to belong, it became quickly very painful.
Right. We had it was one of the surprising things that we found. I'll never forget reading some of the transcripts. There were so many parents that had moved there purposefully because the school there is amazing. And the matriculation rate is incredibly high. And it's like in the 99th percentile in reading and math and this, all the various scores. And the kids, they all go to great schools. I mean, they don't all go to great schools, but they, you know, your opportunities are much higher there. Yet at the same time in those interviews, a lot of those parents were aware or had heard about the academic pressure, about, you know, the suicide problem that was there. Maybe they didn't know as much about it or how big it was, but they knew and they still moved there, right? And it wasn't as clear cut as they didn't regret the decision. But they definitely, you know, made a decision to try and improve their kid's life, even in the face of that possibility.
I think it was a complicated, like once they were there, a lot of them had pretty complicated feelings about whether or not they had made the right choice.
Interesting.
Are you sure this wasn't a study of my daughter's high school?
Oh, no.
How do you characterize the process that leads young people to take their own life, though? So how has it evolved and where is it now? If you were pressed to quickly describe the process as you see it.
I would say that it's very complicated. And that we need a lot more research, frankly. A lot of the research is dominated by a very clinical perspective, which of course comes with quite a few biases. At the same time, I would say that it is a complicated process that involves an intermingling of, you know, biological, genetic, social, psychological, emotional, and environmental sort of risk factors. But the really sad truth about suicide is that even clinicians who are incredibly highly trained and specialized in suicide actually have a very difficult time predicting which of their patients who might exhibit a number of risk factors are the ones that are going to actually, you know, escalate to a suicide attempt or even a death.
Right.
So it's a really challenging problem.
And there's definitely some limitations to what we're trying to do in the sense that, you know, we're really interested in these types of high schools and these types of communities where, you know, singleton suicides are just like, you know, a suicide that occurs anywhere in the United States or in Canada or wherever, that's not linked to a cluster, that's not linked to the process of diffusion, you know, that is, I think, its own sort of process. And so we're just far more interested in how a community comes to not only house, you know, a dyadic diffusion, but how it can also become a cluster site as well as recurring clusters, which is, you know, not always the case. So there are a lot of high schools, for instance, that look like Poplar Grove. In fact, most high achieving high schools probably look almost exactly like it. But they don't all have, you know, the suicide problem, and they don't always have a cluster that occurs after an adolescent suicide, which is really what we're trying to get at in Poplar Grove and ultimately, you know, with another project, with the next project that we want to start on.
I have a question for you. It's not my question. One of my students is actually working on a project, and I was hoping you could give her some advice on where to go with this. So, I have a student who has been tracking sort of trends in like demographic trends in suicide rates over time. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that she's noted is that, you know, like, I guess post 2007 or 2008, there was a like a significant rise in the suicide rate of kids under the age of 12, right? And that where we see, where she sees the largest growth in that age group is among African American youth. Mm-hmm. Like, so, which is strange because in looking at the demographics, she's like, well, for like looking specifically at African Americans, their rates of suicide are lower, right, than whites, or actually, like, for sure, whites, right, mm-hmm. and have been for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But one age group for which this is not the case is under the age of 12. So how would you recommend she go about trying to frame this theoretically? Because I don't know, I don't think it's a Durkheimian story the way that we think of Durkheim.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's just, this is one of the frustrating things, is there's so much work to do and so much that we don't understand. So, I mean, one place she could start just very concretely is there's a scholar named Sean Joe at Washington University in St. Louis that he actually does some pretty fantastic work on suicide among people of color. And so that would be one researcher that I would look at. One sort of caution I would say is that, you know, sometimes we assume that suicide is a white problem, or at least I've encountered that when, you know, people have like talked to me about my research, and yes, in Poplar Grove, it's a majority white community. But actually, you know, adolescents, like in no race or ethnic group of adolescents is suicidality. So that's suicide ideation, rates of suicide attempts. But not deaths, like all of those are actually fairly substantial problems across race and ethnic groups, including African-American girls and boys. And actually Latinx girls and boys and Asian American girls and boys actually have rates that are kind of on par with white students. Mm-hmm. Death rates are always really complicated. You know, we have some really interesting work by like folks like Stefan Timmermans and actually a demographer named Ian Rocket as well. And there's I'm probably forgetting some other people that have shown that, you know, even how things come to be ruled as a suicide death and not an accidental death is quite complex.
Oh yeah.
And so I think we always have to be a little bit careful. And then of course, especially among kids, I think it's age 10 to 14 is probably the category that your student is thinking about. I'm pretty sure.
That's probably right. Yeah.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's very rare, right? It's a very rare event. Even though she's absolutely correct that it is one of the groups that's experiencing the most substantial increases in the suicide rate right now. And, you know, it's tough because we really, I know of very little work that's actually focusing on that age group. So the door is wide open. She has a dissertation topic. Sure. She can go forth and conquer, but she might be kind of breaking new ground, which is exciting but challenging.
Yeah, it's really the dirty secret of the sociology of suicide is that it is according to Open Syllabus, it's the fourth most assigned book in the discipline suicide is. And we talk about it as if it's a fact that Durkheim's theory is a solved fact, yet it is a very rarely studied phenomenon in sociology. Since the 1980s, I think there was only 180 articles published as of 2012 in sociology on this subject, whereas in, say, psychiatry, there's been over 9,000 articles, molecular biology, over 1,000 articles. We just don't study it. And there's a lot of like huge gaps in what we do and don't know. So you know, the African-American suicide rate, you know, there's some, we know that it was relatively, well, quite low comparative to the white rate, but there's almost so little research on it that there's almost no explanation for it. Almost invariably the fallback was on a cultural argument that the community tends to center, you know, very Durkheimian, the community tends to center around a church and, you know, there's these tight kin networks and everybody supports each other, but there's really been no effort to test that
I know, right? Couldn't it just be like, you know, if you live in a household that's multi-generational, you just don't have enough privacy to commit suicide?
I mean, that could be possible. It could also be what Anna's talking about in terms of the rates. I mean, we know smaller communities, closed communities, are more likely to want to protect against, you know, the death being considered a suicide for shame for the family, shame for the community. And I mean, I don't know if that's actually the empirical case here, but we just don't know. I mean, it's really like a great opportunity for any, you know, graduate student. Because there's almost 100 different ways one could take research in suicide.
Yeah, you know, one of my former students, he's non-traditional. He's a veteran, mm-hmm. right? And he did, I can't remember how many tours in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Mm-hmm. And we would have these discussions about you know, what seems to be this rash of, or epidemic, as some people say, of suicides among veterans mm-hmm. of these wars or conflicts in particular. And I remember asking him, well, I mean, have you read Durkheim? And he was like, what? And I was like, and he's like, yeah, no one in the military who's trying to study like the increase in suicide mm-hmm. rates like within this group have been thinking about Durkheim at all. They're only citing like the clinical literature. And I think that's another place where there is this like really, really great opportunity for sociologists to come in and say, okay, we're going to explain it to you using our language.
You've been listening to The Annex, sociological podcast. Special thank you to Anna Muller of the University of Chicago and Seth Averton from the University of British Columbia. We're on the web, www.sociocast.org/annex, on Twitter @SociAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.